Welcome back to Gentlemen Prefer Bonds. I'm Will Daniel.
And I'm Will Schlick.
And I'm Max Wilcox. Vroom vroom.
Tonight we're continuing our series of Bond adjacent material and talking about John Borman's 2001 film adaptation of John le Carré's 1966 novel, The Tailor of Panama. This is a movie that stars Pierce Brosnan as a womanizing MI6 agent. It opens with a shot of the real MI6 building in London. We all, of course, know from the Bond movies. Jeffrey Rush also references Sean Connery in the during the opening title sequence. So all in all, felt very relevant to our chosen subject material here at Gentlemen Prefer Bonds. Did you guys enjoy The Tailor of Panama?
I did. I have a soft spot in my heart for movies like this. I don't know, they don't make them all that often, but like, you know, kind of good grounded spy thrillers, just like any kind of thriller that's a very like human story.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not about being flashy or being like an action movie necessarily, so this was right up my alley.
Are you telling me that you guys hadn't seen that you guys didn't do Panama watches as a kid? That, like, your family didn't get together every 6 months.
And do, we called it Top.
Exactly. Yeah, you weren't Top Boys. Yeah, that's what we all called ourselves.
I think this was my third time watching this. I hadn't seen it probably since college though.
I was not a Top child, unfortunately. So this was my first time.
This was also my first time. I'd never seen this movie before.
You know, stars some of my favorite Latin American actors like John Polito and Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah.
I mean, we can just dive right into that. That didn't age well.
I'll tell you what, I watched this movie. It wasn't good in media res. It wasn't good in its occurrence.
Yeah.
I love Brendan Gleeson so, so much. And he is such a good actor, and boy, was he set up to fail so horrifically in this. I don't know how it does. Do you say yes to this just because you're like, when else am I going to get to work with Pierce Brosnan and Jeffrey Rush? Like, is that why you say, I will gladly play the disgraced Panamanian, like, freedom fighter?
Revolutionary.
Like, yeah. I, Brendan Gleeson, possibly one of the most Irish human beings in history. Not helped by the fact, let me put it this way. There's a scene with all three of them, and I'm sitting there and I was like, so you have, there's an Australian man playing, a royal pronunciation British man next to an Irish man playing a Londoner next to an Irish man playing a Panamanian. Yeah. And they're all of their accents when they were in scenes together were on thin ice. Because it was three men that would be like, when the camera's not rolling, they are different human beings.
For sure, yeah. Did you clock their little boy is Daniel Radcliffe?
Yeah.
I think in his first movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has a lot of dialogue. That little boy has like 6-7 lines.
Yeah. He's just doing childhood stuff, like going to school and saying, like, Dad, can you make me pancakes, you know?
Yeah. At one point, the pancake levitates, and, like, that's just your kind of hint of what's going
to come.
Yeah.
Everyone, that's the secret Harry Potter starter.
When did the first Harry Potter part. Movie come out?
So this came out in, I think, like, March of 01, and that movie came out in November, so the same year. I'm guessing it might have been shot like a year after this or something, because he looks way littler in this movie.
He does. He looks very young here. Like,
well, we've watched enough movies just as people, and even just in the time of this podcast, boy howdy, can you feel when you're watching this movie that this was a movie that was sat in an editing station for 6 months?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Like, the amount of cuts and jumps, yeah, and stuff, you can feel that like they were really excited by what they had, and then they got into the room and they're like, ooh, we have a second sort of production time to go through. Like, this shit, they clearly got like got all the raw footage back and were like, how do we stitch this together?
Yeah, because you think, like, you wouldn't think now or even 20 years ago you'd want to make, you know, a John le Carré, the Tailor of Panama, and have it be like an hour and 40 minutes with these actors. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if it was just if they had a 2.5 hour cut that they thought was boring or something. Or
it feels it like you can feel there are so many scenes that either one happened fast, or the amount of conversations that are Brosnan Rush conversations that are like one static convo that takes place over like four very disparate shots.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it feels like they shot the full conversation of each of those scenes in each location and then like end up stitching a bunch of them together. I don't like John Borman. Man, if this movie taught me anything, and I really enjoy this movie, I like it and I like the script and I like everyone in it. I'm gonna shit on it a bunch just because it's fun, but like, I really enjoyed it and I had a great time, and I really want to read the book. I did like a bunch of research while I was watching it because I was so interested. Holy crap, is everything and everyone in this movie done a disservice by the direction.
Yeah, it does feel like if a Steven Soderbergh or like a Coen brothers had gotten a hold of this at the same time, it's maybe an awards contender. It might be a hit, which this wasn't very successful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, this only made 28 mil on a 20 mil budge.
Yeah.
And like the opening weekend in the US, I think didn't crack 200,000. If I'm not mistaken.
Wait,
which is
200,000?
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm pretty sure that I read somewhere that the opening weekend in the US, because it was 28 overall, but the opening weekend in the US, I'm pretty sure was like crazy small.
Yeah, this feels like a movie that was made for a largely British audience for some reason.
Yeah, and, by an American studio.
Yeah, by an American studio, which is weird. But it also, it was a co-production, I think, with someone across
there was
the
an,
pond.
There's an Irish studio that was also involved. But it feels like a British film. It feels like something that was shot, you know, on the Bond sort of set pieces and stuff. It takes place in it's shot in 2001. Which two Bond movies is that between again, Will?
So it comes out. It's coming out about a year after World Is Not Enough and about a year before Die Another Day.
Yeah. Probably a big part of why people don't end up like he is so different and he's so good in this movie, but I can't imagine that anyone that was cutting a trailer for this wasn't just going to be like, it's Bond, it's James Bond, go see our movie because it's James Bond. But like, I feel like, as happens a lot with populace, that like then they get driven away because of that.
Yeah. I didn't watch the trailer for this. I should.
I'll be honest. I didn't either. I just know I can tell you what it looks like. I bet that shot for shot, I can tell you what it looks like. And I bet that a trailer that should start with Jeffrey Rush features 90% Brosnan.
It seems funny 20 years ago also to not put Jamie Lee Curtis above the title.
Yeah, this is after a bunch of her sort of bigger stuff, yeah?
Yeah, pretty much, because, I mean, obviously, True Lies is mid-90s. That's a huge hit. Halloween,
and she's so good in it.
And she's come back with Halloween H2O is a couple years before that, and that does really well.
Yeah. And it's also, it's like, it's, man, this movie is a time capsule, because it's also, it is right before Freaky Friday, mm-hmm. where sort of our generation is quote unquote reintroduced to her.
Yeah.
But I completely agree with you. I guess they really wanted to just try to use the cachet of like, this is clearly a two horse movie.
Yeah.
Right. Like, Le Carré talks about it. I did a bunch of research, and he talks about the characters because he, Jeffrey Rush's character, what's his name? Pendle.
Yep.
He loves him. like he's one of Lacaille's favorite characters that he's ever written, and he thinks that he's like beautifully kind and tragic and this, that, and the other, and like some of that comes through in the movie.
Yeah.
But it's and like honestly at its best when Pierce Brosnan is like doing a great job of making you hate him. But I maybe that is why. Because also, something that I was reading is that her character is way bigger in the books.
I mean, yeah, I believe that.
But there is a bunch of information about like her as a person that honestly that gives her character better credence. For example, she is a younger sister. She's described as being incredibly bookish and sort of like always focusing on her career and always being a deferential person because her sister is like. You know, she has classic second child syndrome of just like, you know, the first kid being on a pedestal and being this, that, and the other. And it like, from everything that I was reading, it was essentially showing that it like, it paints her in a more positive light as to like, how did you not know your husband was being a spy?
Well, just reading, like, I read through the whole like Wikipedia summary today to be like, make sure I got all that. And like, just the stuff explaining like Harry Pendle in that talking about the movie, I was like, I bet this character fucking rules in the book. Like this, it all just plays like, yeah, like that their character stuff is probably a lot great. And, you know, just has a lot of time to develop in a 300-400 page novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was watching this. I was like, and I this is one of my favorite things. I bring it up all the time, but man, did it make me want to see the like HBO 9 episode, 8 hour long version of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is definitely an example of something I think that's probably just better as a book always. Cause it sure. is,
could be nowadays, it would probably be a great miniseries.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a great miniseries. It definitely needs to be a little bit longer form than what they have here. And I think like most Le Carré novels that they kind of are better on the page and maybe even as like a mini series, you know, like The Night Manager. But yeah, this is a very human drama and like I think a character driven drama and spy story, and like you don't really get to spend enough time with all the characters and like really get into them.
Yeah,
they're all cool.
There's so like many great characters.
Yeah, there's so many great characters and there's like great nuggets for all of them, which is what makes it fun and interesting, but it's not enough to make it really good.
I completely agree. It is you can sense what it wants to be, and honestly, it's at its best when Brosnan is on the screen.
Yeah,
like he clearly got the sort of tone because like it is supposed to be sardonic. It's supposed to be funny in a sad way. Like it is supposed to be a very dark comedy, but in the more classical sense of like, look at all of these things happening to this man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Harry Pendle.
To Harry. Osnard happens to him.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the point. And Brosnan does such a great job of selling that, where from the first minute that they meet, Jeffrey Rush, like, he doesn't get to do anything or make any decisions.
Yeah.
That's sort of the exact point.
Until he starts, like, pumping up the stuff and the silent opposition and everything.
Yeah.
No, but that's the point. That's exactly what Osnard wants.
Oh, because because he's giving him what he wants to hear, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Osnard doesn't care the whole point. Yeah, yeah. And it's apparently even more ambiguous in the books. But the point is that you're not supposed to know whether or not Osnard has known the whole time,
mm-hmm.
whether or not he ever cared that it was real or not, because that's the exact point is he was like, he's just a guy sent down here that nothing's going to hurt him anyway.
Yeah.
If a civil war happens down here, then he's just like, oh, well, guess what? You know what happens when there's a big, terrifying civil war? The embassy's close.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we go home. So he's like, he doesn't care. That was the whole point. He was like, and they say that he has the great moment in the movie when he's like, all this stuff that you're giving me isn't enough. London wants papers. He's not saying that he needs it or anything like that. He's saying you don't understand. The higher ups need actual proof.
Yeah. I do like really like his character too, because he's, I don't know if there's ever been a character like it where a spy that you've had bad spies in a lot of movies, like people that are double agents and things like that. But you know, then you have like your real noble spy. You never had a spy. I've never seen any a spy in anything that I can recall. He's just a piece of shit. He's not necessarily bad. Like he's not working
he's
for that bad.
He's not a believer
like,
in anything really. Yeah.
Like this guy just is a bad person. Like a shitty human being who just is out for himself.
Just through and through.
Yeah. I don't know if you see that in anything else. Like this guy just is like.
Yeah. There's no nationalism. No. There's no like, yeah.
Which to me is like enough for this movie to exist. Like taking Brosnan, you know, 20 years ago, one of the most charming, handsome people alive, and just you know, part of the reason I wanted to do the you know, characters, actors kind of playing against type bonus list for this one is just I was like taking that persona and just, well, what if James Bond didn't have any morals or didn't care about England or, you know, making sure these people stay alive or whatever, and he's just like completely off the leash and like, oh, I'm just gonna like fuck around down here and like cause some trouble and try to make, you know, try to steal some money from the government basically.
It's a perfect heel turn. And that's what I keep saying, is that he, in a movie where a lot of people don't quite know what they're doing, because again, I feel like that from the top down the direction just left a lot of them feeling listless. As good as I think Jamie Lee Curtis is in a lot of these scenes, and I think she is, because I think she's a really great actress, she and Jeffrey Rush have no chemistry.
Yeah.
There's nothing going on. They subsist on the fact that they're both very good actors.
Yeah.
So it's like, there are so many things that don't work in this movie. And at the same time, the work that Pierce Brosnan and Jeffrey Rush are doing together is so good.
Yeah.
And every one of their scenes together is riveting. The them together in the gay nightclub is so good. And it, like, it's a scene that if you just changed one or two of the sort of shots, if you change some of the angles, if you brighten it up, by the way, because holy crap is the color palette bland for this whole movie.
That
you could do that exact scene word for word, line for line, shot for shot now, and it would be an A+ scene.
Brosnan's so good in this movie at just showing absolute disgust also, and not like how, like Bond would be too, you know, polite and British to show how he really feels about, like, in this movie when he meets Brendan Gleeson, he's got his arm around him and just the look on Brosnan's face where you're like, oh, I have a pretty good idea what Brendan Gleeson smells like in this scene.
Brosnan is really good in it, and it's a really fun character for him. It's kind of a riff on his Thomas Crown Affair, like charming con man, like charming, you know, kind of not so great person, but more fun.
Oh, yeah.
This guy is just a total piece of shit with no redeeming quality. Like, he's just charming and then has no other redeeming qualities. He's just awful.
Yeah, they show how successful he is, right? He's able to, with very little effort, seduce one of the sort of foreign secretaries, the assistant
ambassador.
He delivers a, if he was playing it nicely, a very Bondian line when he's opened up the safe.
Yeah.
She asks him, like, she catches him and it clearly pisses him off. Not pisses him off. Clearly gets his goat just a smidge, because he was trying to impress her, that show that he can he knows how to open the safe, and he's doing this great little monologue. She just goes, "The safe was open the whole time, wasn't it?" And he's just like, "What?" I don't know if you guys had the exact quote, because I didn't write it down. But it was essentially, do you have it?
I do, because we were just talking about it before you came in. I was saying how much that's like a Bond line, but it just feels so horrible coming from him.
Smarmy.
Which the line is like, it was open.
It's like tight due to lack
of use
or something.
It just was tight, yeah. It just hadn't been used in a while, so it was very tight.
Just perfect. And it was that great bit too, because the point is that Bond would have said that where only she could hear. In this scene,
there's another
other guy is there. The other guy comes in as he's saying it. And it's like, that's the difference. This guy does not care.
Yeah.
Does not care what anyone thinks about him.
Oh, yeah. He like, when he's running out of there at the end, and like everyone's, you know, running around seeing to important things at the embassy, and he's just like, how about a farewell fuck?
I like too the fact that they just kind of basically have him chain smoking. There's something that just is so like indicative of chain smoking movies. Like, this guy's really, he's having a tough time with everything. Like, he's also, I love the line where he goes to the embassy for the first time, and the guy's like talking to him about how he, the guy that he doesn't like who works there, is like talking about how he's stuck in Panama. He's like, yeah, well, I got demoted here. You know, like, what's your reason for being here?
Yeah,
like,
he's basically like, yeah, exactly.
You just suck all the time. Like, I'm good, but I just was a piece of shit, so I got sent down here.
The in a change that I think is just about the only real change from the novel. A lot of this movie is honestly very, very tight to the book, because Le Carre was in on the writing process.
Right.
But Osnard gets shot in the head by Harry at the end of the book, which, yeah, I would have loved to have seen that.
That would be
the
really
idea
satisfying.
Of a good man pushed to the end, you know?
That would be really satisfying. It also just works in this kind of thing, that have the bad guy get away, where you're like, yeah, that's also like what actually happens.
Yeah,
is he just, you know, puts a big enough bribe? What does he pay the guy, a million and a quarter or something, to get on the plane and then walks away with what, the rest of the 15 million or something?
Yeah,
they do a. We at least now are a little bit better at it. Again, if you did this as a mini series or a movie now, you would do the actual ending. But the actual ending is that he does go home. He does like confess to his wife, and I'm pretty sure that like they do have that sort of beautiful moment where she accepts, because she does love him so truly, because he is a good person. But then he goes to his window and he watches Panama burn, and the implication is that like he ended the world. Like he is solely responsible at this point for a new war in Panama, as America has literally invaded.
Yeah.
Which is, because it also takes place, the movie that they had it take place now, but the book takes place in the 90s, back when it was a lot more.
Wait,
sort of
60s?
No, the 90s.
90s.
Oh, what?
They have it take place during, like, when what's his name?
I thought it was
take place a little bit earlier, actually, because they talk about how what's his name, who was the Panamanian, basically de facto dictator?
Noriega.
Yeah, Noriega. They talk about Noriega a lot. Or they talk about him in that scene where they're briefing Brosnan about how the Americans basically, like, this is supposed to take place right after Noriega's been basically deposed, I think.
And that's what I'm saying, is I'm pretty sure that it takes place in the
'90s.
Early
'90s. But I think in the movie it's supposed to too. Like, I think it takes place the same time as the book.
It takes place in
they say in the opening text about what happened in '99, where Panama regained control of the canal.
Oh, yeah, the canal. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, because it is supposed to be about, and that is why it does feel just a little awkward, that conversation about the sale of the Panama Canal, where like they do start the movie and they're like, Panama has control of the canal, and we all know nowadays, because we're all better trained at sort of global affairs, that means that it's not going anywhere. That means that Panama is going to control it, because that's money. You don't sell it. The point was, is that when the novel came out, it was a question mark.
Yeah.
That was the issue. That is why that's why it was sort of a far bigger deal, and that's why it was a big deal to people in our parents' generation, is it's like, if China owns the only sort of passageway between the Americas, then like, you know, then you're on your way to World War III, right?
Yeah.
Like, that is sort of that concept, where it's like, you cannot let a foreign power have hold over this place and this piece. And then in 98, like, Panama regains control, and it's like that it just became less of an issue. So like, that is, I think, something that does the movie a little bit of a disservice, but it was such a new thing that I think that they were like, well, how are we supposed to set a movie 8 years ago. Like, it's not quite historical, but it's not quite not historical.
Yeah, I guess the closest we see that sometimes now when, like, we're doing like 9/11 stuff or like stuff about 9/11 a couple years after was
happened.
Yeah. Yeah, bunch of great movies. Did you read in the novel Andy Osnard is 27?
Which so, I think could have been awesome.
Yeah, that feels like actually the right age for like
the young kind of fuckboy.
Yeah, like young fuckboy, because like this guy feels like he's too. Brosnan maybe feels like he's a little too old to have gotten away with being this big of a piece of crap for so many years.
He only gets away with it because we all have that predisposed place in our hearts where we're like, spy. Yeah, you know Pierce Brosnan, the spy.
Yeah.
Well, he said he like Borman asked him to do Tailor of Panama, and he was like, "Oh, I assume you're gonna have me play the tailor." Which would be interesting. I feel like a Brit who could have also done that at this time and would maybe be Hugh Grant, because it feels sort of bumbling in that way a little bit, where it's like it is kind of the Harry Pendle feels like a Coen Brothers character or something, where there's a little bit of like William H. Macy in Fargo or something, or it's not as like sleazy or like destructive, but like really kind of charming, doesn't really have it together, and is just in over his head in this whole world.
Yeah, I think Rush pulls it off pretty well, that feeling
of it. He's good, yeah. I think it's more believable that like a Hugh Grant would be married to Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, that's the thing where it's like I love, and that to me is that place where I'm like, it's not anyone's fault because they all do their best in the roles that they were cast in. It's the fault of directing and casting to have put them in those situations.
But Brosnan said he then like worked with talked through
an asshole expert. He worked with a professional douchebag to really sort of like dig into the role.
He just hung out with Joel Silver for a while. It's like, got it. he said that he talked with John Le Carre, and together they just like filled in like what have the last 20 years of Osnard's life been, basically.
That makes perfect sense, because he comes in and he does feel the most fleshed out of any of them. And you can feel, as I was watching it, I was like, I bet that Pierce Brosnan likes all of his books. I was like, I bet that this is a dude he actually reads, because he's one of the only people in the movie that understands the sort of world. Like, the scenes with him always feel different because they're more cutting. They live in a slightly heightened reality, and that's the point. That's where the book is supposed to live, is in this and sort of an alt history version where everyone is, it's like if In the Loop had a lot more murder. Supposed to be that a heightened world where bureaucracy wins out over common sense. Like, it's supposed to be like Dr. Strangelove. Le Carre wrote in the dust cover of the novel, and then it's spoken by Jeffrey Rush in the movie, that he says it's Casablanca without the heroes.
Yeah,
right.
That's a good line.
Which is perfect. It's the perfect descriptor of what's going on, and it's just that idea that from the top down, everyone sucks. And that's supposed to be the point, which is why they all buy these dreams that are pitched by this man, because he's the only person among them that is anywhere near pure. The only one that is the only technical criminal, right? The only one that's actually been to prison is the most honest among them. It's just that his honesty is one of a dream and of a vision, and so he makes up stories.
Yeah, it is one of those, like, Dr. Strangelove, like, here's how easy / how stupid it is in real life to start a revolution or change history, completely ruin a country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe a little bit hard for me to buy that it would escalate that quickly.
Yeah, that, but that's with the like heightened, you know.
Yeah.
Spy movie.
And also
quality.
That's the, and also again, as we said, this movie, wall to wall is like 149.
Yeah.
Sorry, is like an hour 49 or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like it is a short little jaunt for a movie that, as you're watching it, I agree with you. It takes place over like six to eight months, right? Like it has to.
Yeah, it has to.
But it feels like it's like a weekend.
Yeah,
it feels
exactly.
Like they sprint through it.
Yeah.
Can we also say just real fast though that so a device that is used mostly because I'm pretty sure the book is first person from the point of view of Pendle. But we have these flashes of his uncle constantly,
mm-hmm.
which like I started to be okay with a little more. Again, it was just a directorial thing to me where like they came across real cheesy on certain points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But can we just point out that that's Harold Pinter?
Yeah.
That is writer and Nobel Prize for literature winner Harold Pinter just playing a guy saying like, don't do it.
Yeah. Sincerity is better than honesty.
Like that's, I looked it up because I was like, how many movies has he been in? And the answer is like way more than I thought, but not enough that it wasn't weird to me that I was like, that's Harold Pinter. What are you doing?
The Rewatchables podcast always this the best like that guy award for like character actor whose name you probably don't know and you're like, oh, that guy, and like this movie is ripe with those candidates. Like,
yeah,
you've got, you know, John Polito's the president, Dylan Baker's like the American general, who was in charge of
who stands up and has like a tiny monologue.
Yeah.
We're like, all right, guy.
Like guy who's not gonna be in the rest of this movie.
All right.
You have
dude.
Tio from Breaking Bad, Mark Margolis is the guy.
Oh yeah, from Scarface. Yeah. Yeah. Jonathan Hyde from the Mummy and Titanic.
What does a woman know?
And Martin Ferrero, the lawyer in Jurassic Park.
This is
the cast of this movie is weirdly stacked with exactly
yeah.
as you said,
yeah,
with people
guy,
here
yeah.
like, I know exactly who you are.
Yeah.
It's stacked with Newmans. It's stacked with who's that guy? Yeah. Oh, he's Newmans.
Yeah.
I don't know his name, but I'll tell you exactly who he is.
Yeah.
He's the lawyer from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, that's Dodgson there. Let's see.
But that's the exact point, right? Imagine this same cast, but this movie gets to be 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Those actors are all great, and they're all playing roles that feel like they should be that size.
Yeah.
They're playing roles where it feels like they should have, like, 3, 4, 5 scenes where they're doing their own stuff. But, like, yeah, it feels like, exactly as you said, it feels like this movie is supposed to be 2 hours 40, and they just left an hour on the cutting room floor because they realized that it was 2001, and that like audiences weren't going to sit through like a sort of a spy epic in the way that Le Carre wrote, right?
Yeah.
Like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, we all like it. It's slow.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of the point. That's the way he writes.
Well, and this has a more kind of darkly comic satirical tone than that also, where like movies with this tone often don't get to be really long, even now. So you got to remake this now. Who are you casting?
What hot fuckboy is
yeah.
what 20
what,
like?
I was gonna
what
go
hot
with
British fuckboy. Are you putting
same age as Brosnan in this and say Idris Elba?
No, I think you actually have to go the age.
Wait, Idris Elba is not the same age as Brosnan was in this movie, right?
They're both like 50.
No,
okay.
But how old
okay,
was Brosnan
when they
this
filmed
movie?
This, like maybe like 48, I think Elba's like 50 now.
Brosnan was 48 when they filmed this?
He was born in 53. It came out in the start of 01, so he's 47.
Okay, maybe. Yeah.
You know the year that Pierce Brosnan was born?
I believe I could tell you all the Bond's birth years, yes.
I didn't know he
so
was that
impressive
old.
In like a... All right, man.
I'd probably cast someone younger, because I feel like, again, like he's too old to have gotten away with being this 20s. Terrible for so long. Like, you know,
okay,
he's
so we're
made,
casting someone our age.
Yeah,
so.
Like, he's made... The fact
yeah,
that...
Yeah, 20s, 30s.
He made his first mistake sleeping with some foreign minister's like mistress or whatever. Like,
well,
feels like this guy has had to have made mistakes earlier. Well, he's this impulsive and bad.
Yeah, he says something about gambling debts. He says like the gambling debts and the wives. Like, it seems like he's been into a bunch of shit.
Yeah, it implies that he has had several wives that he has cheated on several times. Yeah. This is probably very much due to the fact that I've now seen Bullet Train twice in theaters. Aaron Tyler Johnson.
I like that. So are
Aaron
we gonna,
Tyler Johnson could be awesome as just a royal douchebag.
So are we going 40s for Pendle and the wife then?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Or you got to go like 45 to 48 him and then like 37 her. They have to span the ages because you have to feel like she is going to sleep with him.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Right? So like that is, so you have to go like, all right, I can imagine why she's married to this guy, because there's like 8 years difference between them. They met a little later in life. Like, that is not a very weird sort of like age discrepancy when you meet past, you know, high school and shit like that. Mm-hmm. Like, if you meet and one person is, you know, 35 and the other's 27, like, that's not weird. But, and then, you know, you're married for a while, you have two kids, and then along comes Aaron Tyler Johnson.
Yeah.
So like, who's in their mid-40s? What actor? All of them is the short answer, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, like, all the, you want someone who's like charming, but like not that sexy, like still convincing.
Like this would be a good role for, and he might be a little too sexy, but I think you can, like, Tom Hiddleston could nail this role, and I think he might be in that range. Like, he's not that jaw dropping looking where you couldn't
believe
him as like a sort of
bumbling.
I was gonna say,
stick some glasses on him, put a bad haircut on him.
Yeah.
Put him in a suit that's like a little too old fashioned and like maybe honestly doesn't quite fit like super great, because he doesn't size himself or make stuff for himself.
Yeah.
Jim Broadbent, could 70-year-old Jim Broadbent do this? No. Okay. That was a joke for me.
Are you talking about Jim Broadbent from The Avengers? 1997. The Avengers.
From 90. Yes. Thank you. Yes, thank you. I am.
How about like Anne Hathaway
as Henry?
As Jamie Lee Curtis.
As Jamie Lee Curtis. Yeah, I could totally buy that.
That role to me is best as someone who's a, like, you know, who like fits that role. She might be a little too old now. Is her name Jennifer L? Jennifer Eel, who was
Jennifer Beale?
No,
Jessica Biel?
No.
Jessica Chastain?
You'll know her when you see her. She was in Zero Dark Thirty, I think. This girl?
Oh. Yeah, yeah.
She was in... What else? Oh, she's in The King's Speech. She might play... What's his name's wife in The King's Speech?
Helena Bonham.
I think her probably
about?
10
why
years
did,
ago is perfect.
Why? Yeah. How do the two of you have pictures of this person but not their name? What is this person's?
He said it's Jennifer Eel or L.
Yeah.
E-H-L-E.
It is Jennifer Eel?
Yeah, E-H-L-E.
Yeah, she's probably a little too old now, but this is the person that I sort of imagine is actually, well, like Jamie Lee Curtis, I'm not really
She's great. I love her.
Yeah, she's in a bunch of stuff. Like, I think you actually want more of like a really good character actress who's not like a big star. I'm just not buying Jamie Lee Curtis as like a mother who works in an office in Panama City. for...
Well, give it, again, give it 2 years, and then she's in Freaky Friday, and she's perfect in that.
Yeah, but that's like a ridiculous movie, you know.
I just meant that she plays a mom.
Okay, yeah. What is the...
Oh, I'm okay with her being a mom. She's been a mom before this, because she was in True... She was a mom in True Romance.
Oh, do they have a kid in True Lies?
True Lies, rather, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they've got Christina Ricci and, like, another kid.
Yo, yeah, they have two kids.
I have to rewatch that movie. Yeah. I don't remember that.
We're going to soon.
Yeah, I don't love that movie. Her as, like, a mother or someone they can play that. I more just don't... I don't know. There's something about how tame
to me,
this
I just
role
didn't buy
is.
The
I'm
two
not
of
buying
them.
Her in.
So the, here, well, the other issue is just that... I shouldn't say issue. The other thing is that Jamie Lee Curtis, early in her career, played an I'll say it lovingly because a lot of her characters were literally sex workers. She plays like a sex bot.
Yeah.
She plays a super, like, awesome, attractive lady. You know why? She's super hot and awesome. I love Jamie Lee Curtis.
Well, she's also...
And she, again, she's good in this. She totally is. You just see her and Jeffrey Rush in a room together, and you're like, I know you're not married.
Part of it, yeah.
The thing about her, though, is, like, she's at her best when she's being a little bit bombastic. Like, she plays a lot of, like, really... Like, in Freaky Friday, she's kind of... that's really the only word that comes, like, bombastic or, like, very kind of out there, like, very in your face.
What's the nicest word for battle axe?
And just, like, a very noticeable... Like, she jumps out of the screen. She's just playing, like... This role calls for, like, a more subdued, nuanced... Like, I feel like this character is meant to be more of sort of a very grounded, a little bit of a... Like... Not soft-spoken, but just more measured person, and I don't think she really succeeds at that at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like she's... Casting her kind of feels like they're... Like, they forgot to include, like, the network scene of, like, I know you're cheating on me. I mean, which they sort of do, but it's really short, and he gets away weirdly with, like, oh, I am totally in love with my assistant. Yeah. We just aren't having sex.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
You read it that way? Well, I read it as, like, I love her because, of course, I love her. I love her like a almost like a child.
See,
like, that's how I read it.
Well, that's what I thought at first, and I thought he was gonna say, like, I'm not in love with her, but then he says, I've never made love to her, which is like, well, you're leaving it ambiguous you should specify that you're not in love
that
with her.
To me that to me read like one of those moments that they pulled straight from the book. There's a lot of dialogue in this where like suddenly there's three lines in a row that are better, and I'm like, well, this is clearly in the book. You've clearly pulled this one sort of like word for word, right? That to me, that scene smacked to me of something where they pulled dialogue from the novel, and that like going into that scene, you get the benefit of being inside of his head the whole time, and therefore like you know it better. But it's like that's how I read it, is that like he loves her Marta or whatever her character's name is. Who is stunning, by the way, and is also really good. Everyone's good in this movie.
Oh yeah, so who's Marta and who's is Brendan Gleeson Mickey or something?
Yes.
Yeah. Javier Bardem.
Brendan Gleeson plays Marta. But that's how I read it, is a more innocuous, and that like he just in this one moment he loses his greatest ability, which is his ability to speak and to be a storyteller and stuff, but that he's so frazzled that like he loses that for the moment, is how I read it. But maybe that's just me being very generous to the character because I like the character. But if we're trying to think actresses in their 30s to late 30s, maybe early 40s, that are sort of like big but not too big, right? Is sort of what we're going for.
Yeah, I guess.
And also like could reasonably be a person that like is working like a contractor / construction head on the Panama Canal, or like a person who runs operations on the Panama Canal, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a role that, like, Carrie Mulligan could do really well. She's very good at giving...
I just was going to say Carrie Mulligan.
Yeah.
Yeah, she would do that.
I was just about to say her. I think that that is a... I think that that could be really cool, and, like, that was totally casting that would work. I was going to say her or... And granted, it's just because you can put her in fucking anything, but I was just going to say also Emily Blunt. But she's probably... Well. She might probably be a bit too big now.
I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, I guess she's in more stuff now than Jamie Lee at this time. But
like, she... I also say her because I think she could be in anything because she's just really great. But I have two... I have one that's half a joke and I have one that's a real one for Pendle. Yeah? Are you ready?
Uh-huh.
My joke one, mostly because he's in everything and I just think that he's freakishly talented... He's not British, but he never plays what he actually is. How much money would I pay to watch Pedro Pascal do this role?
Yeah.
And the answer is a lot of money. The answer is I think he would be perfect. My real answer is I think that Cillian Murphy could be cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he is, like, he is attractive. He is interesting. But, like, we've seen now... in Peaky Blinders that, like, he can play the crap out of, like, emotionally vulnerable, sort of broken man.
Yeah.
And he's, like, endlessly watchable. So, like, when he starts doing the sort of, like, storytelling, fanciful thing, like, I can totally imagine, like, a camera slowly tightening in on his exceptionally sharp features. Man, if you cast him and Carey Mulligan, this is a sharp family. You're gonna have to cast the children are gonna be chiseled from granite.
Yeah, those are gonna be very nice looking children.
You know, who could also play Osnard, I feel like, is Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
Sure.
Is he British?
That would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That was good. I thought so. He would be really good. He could really pull off the sleaziness of this. He's good at playing sleazy roles, like Good Time. Yeah. Like,
most important question: who is playing Daniel Radcliffe? What kid do we think is going to break later this year as the next Harry Potter?
Yeah, I'm casting Jacob Tremblay from 5 years ago.
I'm trying to think. Are there any, like, the Stranger Things kids are all older than us now?
Broom Kid. Do I know a child Last actor? Jedi.
Kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone. What about the kid from the It's Corn meme? He's everywhere.
Oh yeah, It's Corn.
It's Corn. That could be great. Give him a sort of a starring role. It'll be great. We won't ask questions as to whether or not, Carey Mulligan and Cillian Murphy adopted or not. Just leave that one up to sort of... But, yeah, I can't think of, like... Oh, you know what? You know what's going to be easy peasy? I'm just going to wait until Percy Jackson comes out on Disney+.
Oh, my God. You stole the thought out of my head.
Just steal one of those little kids.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that they're pretty good. Disney cast kids... Great all the time.
Yeah, who wasn't the chubby friend from Jojo Rabbit is the new, like, Home Alone kid on Disney+. Use that kid. I bet he's still really small.
I bet he's still tiny. Hey, why not get just actual Jojo Rabbit kid at that point?
Yeah.
Fine. I'm just saying, we got some juice on the kid who's in Home Alone, you know. We goose him a little bit.
Yeah, we goose him, I guess.
Yeah.
just goose him. I'm glad we play that game every time, and I am going to be the person that brings it up every time. But, man, I do really want to see a remake of this, because I think this movie is fine,
yeah,
but not perfect, which, as I've said before, is exactly what should get remade.
Right.
Movies that are fine but not great.
So here's your option. You get best possible... movie version. Say there's, you get a Scorsese or a Villeneuve or whoever you think would nail this the best to make, like, 2.5-hour version of this for theaters, Or we could do a 6 to 8 hour version on HBO with the best writers, directors doing that.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's best as a mini series. This is it will always work better as a mini series.
Yeah, 100%. You get
I think that tone also, because it's like if it ends up a little bit like Succession or something like that, where, as you said, it's funny but in kind of a sad, dark way, where it's like you don't necessarily want to spend 3 hours in one sitting in that world, but like 1 hour is like, this is amazing.
Yeah,
and then you can really like dig down on the fact that like this guy is slowly losing. I was reading a review from the time, like from the time period of when the movie came out, and there was someone said that something that I thought was really great and really prescient is that there was not prescient, but a really together thought on the character and on the movie, and he was like, Pendle from scene to scene is building a card pyramid, and every scene that something new happens, it's just about to fall, and he just places one more card right on top. And that is supposed to be the feeling, right? And you could get that so much better in 8 hours, where you start off, and for the first maybe 2 hours, you're like, this is going to be really fun. This is a miniseries about a man who tells an awesome story and saves his farm. And then so that 5 hours in, you can be like, is this country going to explode?
Yeah.
Like, that should be the buildup.
Yeah, that would be good, just seeing how close he comes to utter catastrophe before he just gets away with it each time again. Well, all right. Any more thoughts on Tailor of Panama?
When they are in the brothel, Pierce Brosnan turns on the magic fingers, already great. They then conclude their business. He hands him a spy camera. He turns and says, look at those great tits, and then says, and I quote, I wrote this one down. I didn't have to write it down. I would have remembered it. He looks and says, oof, yum, yum.
There's
some really nice lines in this.
Pierce Brosnan gets a lot of shit. He gets a lot of shit from a lot of people that don't understand that, like, he's great. He's weird, but like when you let him do the stuff he wants to do, he's awesome.
He's such a great asshole. I mean, there's the when he's watching the women dance in the club in one of the first scenes, like the first time he's hanging out, Jeffrey Rush is showing him around town, and he's like, oh, be pretty easy to fuck her. And Jeffrey Rush has the line about, like, oh, you know, many have and wish they had, some had who wish they hadn't. Brosnan laughs really hard.
He laughs so hard. He laughs as if he's like finally accepting that this is a person he can work with.
Yeah, he's like, all right.
He laughs as if he was on the fence until that moment. And then he's like, oh, it's okay, it's okay. I have also one very last thing, which is that when Jeffrey Rush is complimenting that Panamanian man, saying that he reminded him of Sean Connery, a moment that should have warned everyone in Panama that this man lies. he said, "You remind me of Sean Connery," and he says like you know, stately, like together, whatever. And he says, "Golfer's shoulders."
Yeah, golfer's shoulders. Like, what does that mean,
guys? he said it, and I said to myself, I was like, am I the problem? I.e., is it just that I've never heard this before? I've never heard someone described as having golfer's shoulders.
Yeah.
So you don't think Road Warrior has golfer's shoulders?
I was 5 years old. I have never heard anyone say golfer's shoulders ever.
That, I laughed so hard. I was like, that's amazing. You, in that one little piece of dialogue, by the way, when they make the miniseries, you keep all that dialogue as is, because you learn two things. This man will lie about anything, and this man is not British. Or not British. This man is not, like, stately. This is not actually a man that was, like, on the Savoy and, like, has been dealing with the upper crust, because every one of them would be like, golfer's shoulders?
Pardon?
What? Yeah, that's about what I had to say. I needed to get those two things off my chest before we finished up.
So I thought, based on Brosnan's kind of villainous turn in this movie, it'd be fun to do a list of our favorite movie star playing against type performances. I'm going to have a lot of honorable mentions. I'm going to have a lot of, you know, typically good guys, nice guys playing evil, because that's really fun.
Yeah, that's kind of the main one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have some fun ones. I'm going to have a sort of weird... I'll say up front, as I swat a bug out of the sky, that I kind of purposely don't have anyone who, like, has done a couple, like, this way and a couple that way, but there's one that sticks out. I really wanted sort of people that were, like, a real big swing, like, a real big sort of bite at the apple, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I keep loose because there's one or two of them that I think might appear on in some of y'all's lists. And just to keep the lists sort of fresh, I tried not to put them on mine. And so if no one mentions them, I'll mention them I'll mention them in my also rans. But like, yeah, I tried to just sort of go for big home run swings of just like, he did what?
Yeah.
But yeah, who wants to go first?
Why don't you start? I'm not sure.
Okay. I'm going to start with number five.
Mm-hmm.
My number five is, I think, one that is, definitely will end up in all honorable mentions and probably on some other lists. Tom Cruise in Collateral. Very, very, we've talked about Cruise a lot on this podcast, and I think we've talked about that movie quite a bit, so not too much to say that other than the fact he's really, really good as a full-blown psychopath in that movie. Very, very against type.
Yeah, 100%. Tom Cruise does appear on my mentions, does not appear for Collateral. Is what I'll say. I'll go second for my fifth place. Mine is Daniel Craig in Logan Lucky. He now has done, now that Knives Out has come out, people are more like, he can be quirky. The only reviews you were reading about that movie were people coming out and being like, Daniel Craig did that?
Yeah.
Like, it is a lot of it is to do with the fact that Bond is so specific, and that is obviously what most larger audiences knew him for. But he plays an unhinged wacko in that movie, and he is awesome at it. That is really great, and it snuck into my number five.
Awesome. My number five, I have Humphrey Bogart, who I really could do Treasure of Sierra Madre for this, which is maybe his best movie, and he's really great in that. I think his best performance is in Nicholas Ray's In a Lonely Place. Really sad, really angry, kind of volatile character. He's really terrific in that, and it's not the, you know, tough but moral guy we know from most films that he's in. It's this character who's really a mess, and who the arc of the Gloria Graham character is to learn that she really has to stay away from this guy.
It's funny, I won't put it on there because I sort of forgot about Treasure of the Sierra Madre and just him playing against type in that, mostly because that's such a, like, he's great in that movie, but there's so many great elements in that movie. It's not like a real singular performance. So maybe that's why. I think he plays against type really a couple more times than you think, because I also think he plays a bad guy in a movie called High Sierra right before he becomes a star. Known, though, for his one, the real classic Bogart character. But
I feel like some of those early noirs, like before Casablanca, were more in the classic of, like, because it's going to be the anti-hero, we're going to kind of root for him, even though he's legally in the wrong and will have to die at the end because of the Hays Code. But he doesn't seem as evil as
villainous,
like,
overall.
Yeah, villainous overall as Sierra Madre, or just as, like, troubled as like In a Lonely Place.
Yeah.
So your number four.
Number four for me is Yeah, I tried to think of some interesting ones too, because the ones that are. There's not that many great playing against type roles that are that memorable.
We could all say Robin Williams in 1 hour photo. If you look up lists online, you're going to get the same five performances every time. I feel like all of us are going to try to have lists that are different. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's not to say that I don't agree with those things, but for example, Robin Williams does not appear on my list, and I'll tell you exactly why. The reason why is that the first time he did it is one of the best times he did it, and it's in 89-90 when he does Dead Poets Society. And he's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. But the point is that then he still did comedies and he still did dramas. Yeah. And so therefore, to me, he is just a brilliant actor. So when people say that just to me says that they haven't watched enough Robin Williams movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I throw in like Insomnia would be on my honorable mentions just because we're talking about him. Sure. Already came up. Like he's great in that. It's a really creepy killer.
So The World According to Garp is like the early 80s. And that's, you know, comic but also a very dramatic role for him that he's terrific in. So he really was like, he did a lot of more dramatic turns than I think the average person maybe is aware of.
My number four, I think it pops up a lot, but Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast.
Nice.
Really, really good movie. I love that movie.
It's one of my honorables,
of the more underrated movies of the 2000s, you know, of our lifetime. He's really, really good in it.
Ben Kingsley normally plays an Indian man. This time.
Schindler's List, he reprises his role as Gandhi.
Yeah, I can really only think of one time where he doesn't play, one other time where he doesn't play an Indian man outside of Sexy Beast, which is
Thunderbirds.
Thunderbirds, and Iron Man 3. Like
when he doesn't play, he famously then plays an Asian
Mandarin.
The Mandarin, a Chinese man.
But he's pretty great in Sexy Beast. That's just a great movie. Highly recommend. What an absolute psycho he is in that movie.
Totally on my honorable mentions. I completely agree. My number four, is, Jimmy Stewart, in, I'm calling it, a hyphen. I'll just go with the one, in Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo.
Oh, awesome.
He is a straight up anti-hero. He is insane. He is not the thing that everyone has always loved Jimmy Stewart for, which is the fact that he is awesome and lovable. And perfect and wonderful. He is bonkers in Vertigo. But they all get lumped together because he's so good that he's in a lot of stuff. But if you go back and you actually sort of compare who he normally plays to what he does in that movie specifically, it's very, very cool.
My number four is Jennifer Jason Leigh in The Hateful Eight. She, you know, memorably played a psycho very early on in her career, single white female. But I felt like we had a period of about 20 years where she's playing yuppies going into like just the nice mom is just what she becomes known for. And then for her to be in Hateful Eight and her first line is just calling Sam Jackson the N-word and just a completely gross, despicable, violent character. Not one of Tarantino's better movies. I like it overall. I really like her performance in that.
Yeah, she is very good in it. That movie definitely has strong performances. It's just not really a strong story, and it's not really one of his more well-written movies. Number three for me is Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter.
Oh, awesome.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, you should watch it. You love Night of the Hunter, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I think I introduced you to that.
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't say Robert Mitchum is your classic movie hero, but he sort of plays your classic noir kind of anti-hero or sort of like trouble hero. He's very much in that Bogart camp.
Yeah, he plays a lot of tough guys who you do root for.
Yeah, who you root for. And he's, again, just sort of doing the full-blown psycho thing in Night of the Hunter, where he's just an absolutely amoral, vicious person with no redeemable qualities and pulls it off quite well.
That sort of opens the doors for him to play a couple more iconic villains, at least like Cape Fear comes out maybe like 5 years after that.
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
Oh, Sugar, it's me, isn't it? Number three?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My number three is Albert Brooks in Drive. That is another one that is, I think that comes up a lot when you start to look up the sort of just the concept, because he's Albert Brooks and he's funny and he's a guy that makes you sort of think about things and feel things. Woof, he is bad guy in that movie. A movie that I think rightfully so kind of gets laughed at a little bit now. It was very. It very much was aware of itself and knew what it wanted to be and wanted to do. But like, man, his performance in that is so different than anything else he did in anything else.
Yeah. I think with that movie, what happened is like Nicholas Winding Refn has become such a, I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's proven himself to be such a bad, out-of-touch filmmaker. And yeah. When I say out-of-touch, I don't mean with, like, the times. I mean with, like, any human emotion at all. Like, he's just, like... I don't
humanity,
know.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, he's so out-of-touch with humanity that it... You... Like, watching his movies now and knowing that is just... It makes Drive feel worse and more out-of-touch with humanity. Yeah. But at the time when you see it, it wasn't...
It was very pretty. It's very stylized. It's very a lot of stuff. But you're right. You try to. It's one of those movies that you try to dig down into, or you try to feel more about, and you're like, I'm not sure there is more.
No, it's just Drive is movies are awesome.
Yeah, like awesome. I'm not sure there is more to have out of this, except for that performance, which I think is fantastic.
My number three is Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast.
Nice.
We already talked about it, so I'll just say, look at your skin, like leather is alligator man, fat alligator, fat bastard.
It's just so good.
We've only had one overlap. I'm going to count overlaps, because normally we have at least like four or five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That excites me. What, sir, is your number two?
My number two is, I think, a very famous one. So I think my last two are both pretty famous. I would imagine they're going to show up on at least one of your guys' lists, both of them. Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West. I obviously love Sergio Leone. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. And also, too, for me, I think it's such an like iconic against-type movie because... I had never really seen... I didn't grow up watching a lot of Henry Fonda movies. He just wasn't someone that was in movies that my family really liked, even though we watched a lot of classic movies. So this is the first thing I ever really saw him in. And it's funny. To me, it's almost weird to see him in the movies that where he's doing his normal type of being a good guy, and there's so many of them, because this is the first thing I remember him really being in and seeing. And he's just a really brutal, awful character.
Mm.
And... it's funny how good he is at doing that. That movie's what I think of when I think of Henry Fonda, even though it's against his usual type. But yeah, very, very good performance.
Max? My number two is... sorry, I was just looking at this. My number two is Eddie Murphy in Dreamgirls.
That's a really good one.
He is a legitimate actor in that movie. Eddie Murphy showed up and he does the work. Like, if you are looking at it from a surface level, I get that the idea is that like, he's just sort of doing an impression that we've seen him do blah 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 before. Nah, go rewatch that movie. He works. He has every single level available to him. There's a reason why he won the Golden Globe and I think was nominated for the Oscar for supporting. He absolutely slays and kills it in that movie in a way that's completely different than anything else that he had ever done before and has ever done since. That to me is it should and is going to go down as not only his best performance but a like an outlier. I adore Beverly Hills Cop. I adore everything that he's ever done, but that performance is so, so different.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's did he win an Academy Award for that movie?
No, people blamed it on Norbit came out like a month before the Oscars year.
So. Well, which is even better proof that he was nominated for an Oscar and Norbit came out. Nah, man, he's so good. Also, if you haven't rewatched Dreamgirls and like if you haven't seen it in the last 10 years, just go rewatch that movie. I think it's gonna go down as maybe like as a top five movie musical of all time, like maybe edging out some of your favorites. That movie's great.
My number two is Jimmy Stewart in Anatomy of a Murder.
Nice.
I think it's a great movie. I think it's probably my favorite courtroom movie of all time. And just Jimmy Stewart kind of cunningly like harnessing that leading man charisma, but he's not the sort of honest everyman. He's kind of cynical and doing, he's not the guy who's doing the right thing for the right reason. He's maybe doing the right thing for probably the wrong reason. And just kind of sleazy, and it's every performance in that movie. Lee, who's that actress from The Omen? Anyway, George C. Scott's in it. A bunch of people are in it. Otto Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder. If you've never seen it, check it out.
All right, you know what this means. Your number one has to be Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window. the last in his movies where he is not playing every man sort of heroic hero.
He's so pretty likable in Rear Window, though.
Yeah, I'll go in. Well, I'll start with some honorable mentions because quite a few. And some of it centers around actors that do it really, really well. I'd say first, like, George Clooney in From Dusk Till Dawn and even Burn After Reading. I think what makes George Clooney play against type so well when he does do it is that he uses the same things that make his type fun, which is, like, being really charming. And
he's that kind is of, on mine.
In the most twisted way, so charming in both those movies. I would throw in Paul Newman has some great against type performances, particularly the movies Hud and The Verdict. The Verdict is one of my favorite movies of all time. I would put it on this list if it wasn't. Ultimately, he does kind of become a good guy and proves to be a good guy in The Verdict, who's just kind of down on his luck. So I don't think it's truly against type. He is a hero in that movie.
He plays a lot of kind of troubled anti-heroes. Yeah, kind of troubled anti-heroes, like Cool Hand Luke and
Hud. I don't think it was truly against type, but I didn't put it on here for those reasons.
Cool Hand Luke.
I'd throw Tom Hanks in Road to Perdition on there. Again, I don't know,
he's on my
really like. He doesn't, that's such a nuanced performance. I know he's playing like a more rough and tumble guy than you would ever assume he is.
So he could, here's the thing, right? Tom Hanks could technically appear on this list for a bunch of stuff because we have seen enough movies to understand that Tom Hanks was a comedy yuck sort of skin flick dude. Like, Tom Hanks started, we know is the coin, is the turn in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Bachelor Party was, like, his first successful movie, right? Yeah, so.
Yeah, he was a comedy guy, really. I mean, even Big.
The Burbs, movies are, like, the Tom Hanks that people that don't watch a lot of movies think about is the heel turn. The heel turn was from sort of like a guy in like really good guy in okay movies and B movies and stuff to the fact that they were like, oh, he can actually act, right? Like they stick him in a couple of rom-coms and suddenly people are like, oh, this guy can actually exist. Which is why he like that's that thing, right? Where it's like him, Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, they're not on my actual list because of those exact reasons why, right? They have enough examples where it's like, if you actually know the work, they're just great actors. They are the they are the people that do not have a type and therefore have nothing to play against.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think like he wins the Oscar for 2 years in a row for Philadelphia and then Forrest Gump, and it's like, okay, Tom Hanks is going to be in every genre of movie now for the next three decades.
Anything anyone else on your also-rans?
Yeah, we already talked about him. Robin Williams, particularly in Insomnia, I think is really, really good. So with that, I go to my number one, which I think is a pretty – it's a pretty boring answer, but I think you have to think of it in the context of the time it happened. Heath Ledger is the Joker in Dark Knight.
Totally.
I mean – he died right after it, and I think it's looms so big in his legacy now. Yeah. But you have to remember, when he was cast in that role, it was bizarre. Mm-hmm. Like, it was truly like, why is Heath Ledger being the Joker? Like, he was sort of, definitely, he'd already proven to have some range. Obviously, Brokeback Mountain had already come out. And, yeah. You know, but really, he was kind of seen as like a teen heartthrob sort of guy, very much a like lovable sort of girls like him. But he was cast
those
the Joker,
of us... Those of us who are big A Knight's Tale fans could tell you that he could do anything, but we were few and far between. History has been kind to us as that us movie grows in estimation.
All of us Brothers Grimm fans.
Yeah,
but I think like Brokeback Mountain was sort of the answer to like, well, dude can act, so like, let's see what he does.
But still, it was truly bizarre when it happened. I remember hearing about it when I was, you know, 16 or just like, what the fuck? Like, are you kidding me?
And also every Joker we've had, Cesar Romero, Jack Nicholson, had been like 50.
Yeah.
So it also was like, wait, isn't he like 25?
Yeah. Because I loved Batman Begins and was really, really excited for it. And I have to say, honestly, I was kind of bummed when I heard he was going to be the Joker. I was like, that doesn't seem like a really cool choice. That seems like a weird, like, trying to be against the grain choice with some guy. But he obviously was great in it. So, I mean, how could that not be... That's one of the best ever, if not the most famous against type performance, in my opinion. And also my favorite.
That casting and how good he was in that role that he, quote-unquote, shouldn't have been good in... led to my crusade that will never occur, that is the only thing I wanted in the entire superhero universe, which was Michael C. Hall to play the Riddler.
Yeah.
Because it was the same thing where it's like that thing where you're like, I don't think that would work, but trust me, it's weird enough, it would have been awesome.
I think that would work.
That would be, especially now that people know him more and know that some of his weirder shit more, but like, that is my casting that, like, if I could go back in time and make that happen, I think that would be so, so good. But what is your number? Oh, sorry, that was your number one. Oh, my goodness, my brain.
That's my number one.
My brain's broken. I apologize, everyone. I woke up far earlier than I normally do. I'll do my – I won't mention any of the ones that you mentioned. Almost all of your also-rans are on my also-ran list, right? The also-ran for this is going to be 17 pages long for all of us. What I will say – is Tom Cruise Tropic Thunder. Come on.
Yeah.
Just. That's a good one. Yeah. Just. Like, a weird enough one honestly could have been my number one. Tom Cruise. We espoused for 40 minutes the star quality of Tom Cruise, and for him to do that is insane. Yeah. Like that is a crazy one. Charlie, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, it's... It is funny how much culturally has changed in the last 15 years, where like someone like Taylor Swift is like, I guess I'm really not supposed to swear in my music. You know, that's the era where like Tom Cruise is like, hey, fuck face, take a giant step back and literally fuck your own face.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll go through these relatively fast just in case they're on anyone's list, just because I think these are all... The thing about this list is it's so personal, right? But for the Jim Carrey / Robin Williams reasons, I have Steve Carell's Foxcatcher is on my also-rans. Honestly, Sean Connery in Crusade, another one that I think we are now accepting, but like, he's a nerd. Sean Connery in his career never played a nerd once.
Yeah.
That dude was a man's man, and he was now playing like the clumsy professor. That's also kind of insane.
No, it's funny. I feel like we've really been on the same wavelength today because we've had a couple of times where we're like thinking the same thing. That also popped up in my mind.
Yeah.
That performance in particular, because he's not really being himself.
Not even a little bit. Then my other two
except
are
that he still fucks.
Well,
except that he still fucks. I
well,
said
she, yeah, he still fucks, but
she talks in her sleep. You have to know that. My other two are Charlize Theron in Monster, a very obvious one. The only reason it didn't make my list is because it is so obvious. And then Wesley Snipes in Tu Wong Fu, which is a awesome, weird, bonkers experience that I highly suggest. But my number one, in a grain that this goes in, that a lot of people that don't watch a lot of movies or don't know a lot about sort of film history are going to sort of not understand is Leslie Nielsen in Airplane.
That's totally legit.
He had been not just around, but successful and thriving for 30 years. In the business, in the industry, playing heartthrobs, playing serious roles, playing dramas, and he gets cast in this movie that, if you look at the cast and look at almost all their previous work, is mostly pretty serious actors. Very serious actor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. No. But he comes in and has the timing that is so famous that it is still quoted. Right, and will be quoted into the end of time, and we all just think about his career after. We think about Naked Gun. We think about all the things that he did sort of post. But that's the whole point: is that he already has gray and white hair in Airplane. He had been around. He had established who he was, and this movie came out, and he's so transformative in it that it affected the entire rest of his career until he died. So that is my number one.
The brilliance of him in that movie on his part and the Zucker's Abrams like director writer team is that he's just playing it straight. He's just giving that character and that ridiculous dialogue the same exact performance as you'd give in something like Forbidden Planet, where it's and you know, 20 years later and you know, Spy Hard or Mr. Magoo, he's really like mugging and it just doesn't work to where Airplane is just absolutely brilliant comic performance by him.
So
honorable mentions from me that haven't been mentioned already. Actually, when you were talking about Eddie Murphy, you made me think sort of in opposite terms, coming from drama into comedy. Of, I guess if I had to go one movie, it would be John C. Reilly in
Games
Talladega
of New York.
Nights. But
Talladega Nights. I thought you were going to go the other direction.
Then into that and Step Brothers, because like he's kind of like he's a dramatic actor for like 15 years or so, and there's a difference between giving a funny performance in what's sort of a darkly comic drama like Boogie Nights, and then all of a sudden you're double billed with the comedy star of your era, and you're just as funny as Will Ferrell in two movies in a row.
Huge fucking flex. He's brilliant in Walk Hard.
Oh, Walk Hard is in the middle of those, and that's great too. Yeah,
He's so good. I adore him.
Also, I think worth mentioning Denzel in Training Day.
He
you know, played good strong dudes in movies for 10-15 years. Just plays a really reprehensible character in that movie. Is really great. Just because we just saw it, I thought of Bill Skarsgård in Barbarian, because that guy opens the door to an Airbnb and you're like, I think I know where this is going. And that's it's a lot more interesting than that. I thought of at the time as well, after playing almost exclusively psychos throughout the 90s, for people who hadn't read the book, seeing Gary Oldman in Prisoner of Azkaban, it's like, he's the good guy.
Sure. I like that one a lot. I hadn't thought about that at all.
Yeah,
that one's, I really like that.
You're casting him for people who haven't read the book, basically to like, oh, this is like Air Force One professional guy who's like, oh, wait, okay, it's different.
And you get that great turn, because then he's also Commissioner Gordon, who's also the Goody Two Shoes of Goody Two Shoes. Is like, that's an awesome little place where you're right. He gets to do this complete 180.
And then two more that are I sort of put in the same category of, you know, cool charismatic guy, being if not evil, just sort of mean and slightly immoral. Same with as Pierce Brosnan and Taylor of Panama, or the Ghost Rider, really, which is also good. Or Cruise in Collateral. And I have Cary Grant in Notorious.
Nice.
Really, yep. Good performance.
Yeah.
And Fred McMurray in The Apartment, who, you know, he's toward the beginning of his career, he has Double Indemnity, where he's very much like noir anti-hero, kind of a bad guy, but by the time of The Apartment, he's basically become the Disney dad.
Yeah. You can kind of you can kind of do both of them in The Apartment. Yeah. Is the cool thing.
Yeah, just Jack Lemmon as well. You mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like that's kind of the point, right? They're both reprehensible. That movie is a really cool turn for both of them.
And then my number one is Holly Hunter in The Piano.
She's
been a huge star for almost a decade at that point, and was known for playing these Southern, you know, really talkative characters. Raising Arizona, Miss Firecracker Contest, Broadcast News. A really impressive career. And then Jane Campion was really confused, I think, when a producer or someone was like, "How about Holly Hunter?" And she was like, "What? For the woman who doesn't speak?" And she absolutely nails it. You know, got her Oscar for that. Great performance.
Awesome poll. Hadn't even thought of that. You're dead right. That's awesome. That's that cool thing, right? There are so many. It is great when actors are allowed to do that, because it does end up being some of the best performances. Sure, you can also have hits and misses, right? You can have places that are where people are doing things that they're not maybe not supposed to be doing. One that comes to mind is Jake Gyllenhaal's Prince of Persia is maybe a real big swing and a miss, where everyone was like, "What if this guy was an action star?" And for many reasons, we all said no, thank you. Script and consequence are obviously not script. Script and sort of idea are big parts at play there, but also, like, he's really good at other stuff. He doesn't have to be doing those things. We only had one overlap, which is great.
It was just Sexy Beast, I think.
Yeah.
That is crazy. But one person who I feel like loves to try to pull that off as a director, and like really likes, just because he's super fucking smart and talented to show off to you that he can get away with like his stunt casting, is David Fincher. And like, you definitely, people thought that with like Justin Timberlake's gonna be in Social Network, and he's really great in that. Tyler Perry's really great in Gone Girl.
Yeah.
Neil Patrick Harris, I feel like that's a miss kind of in Gone Girl. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's a swing, and I hope he keeps doing stuff like that.
The funny thing is, he's not really casting against type as much as he's casting people that they're so far outside of anything like this that's like, it's not like, I mean, I guess Tyler Perry's an actor first, but he's more,
I guess,
like
I would use, my phrase, stunt casting,
he's kind of the casting king against type, of like stunt casting, as opposed to maybe against type. But you're right, he does get some pretty cool performances out of people that you would never think it would be good in some. I mean, I don't really know. Like Fight Club, I take like Meatloaf in Fight Club, because Meatloaf's not really an actor at all, to my knowledge. I don't know if I've seen him in anything else.
This and Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Celebrity one or two rehab. Other things. All right, let's be careful, because I very much like Meatloaf. Hold on. I was about to say that the biggest turn that David Fincher the biggest turn that David Fincher had a hand in was maybe Trent Reznor as an aggressively awesome composer, and not just quote unquote just a musician. If we're talking about a thing that he helped, where you're like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah,
I'm sorry, this guy's now gonna be like a top 10 in the world at this. Cool, all right. I didn't have that on my bingo sheet.
Yeah, the Social Network and Gone Girl scores in particular are just so great.
He's doing the score for something else that's coming out this year, right? Oh, it's that he did a thing that was crazy. Oh, sorry, it's two things. It's that he did a thing that I forgot, which is that he did the score to Soul, which is cool and weird. Mm-hmm. He's doing the score to Empire of Light, the new Sam Mendes movie.
Interesting.
Which is a movie that I am also, by the way, very excited to see. I love Olivia Colman so much, and I love Toby Jones, that weird little man. We could talk. That's the cool thing, right? We could talk about actors doing stuff that they normally don't do for literally an entire pod. But we've got a big bag of almost spy movies, and I have a feeling that a certain secret agent by the name of Cody Banks.
Agent Cody Banks, baby. I know. See, that's what we're really vibing today.
I want it pulled so bad. Just because I need to force Will to watch it. What?
Oh, no. Spies Like Us. Sorry, I got a crossed out thing, and I thought I was gonna get Cody Banks, but I got Spies Like Us.
Damn, this is awesome.
This was so close.
This was your recommendation for the bag. Yeah.
Have either of you seen it?
I've seen it. Yeah.
No. Wait, you've never seen it?
You're gonna have fun. You're gonna have fun. I'm not saying it's great, but you're gonna have fun. very, very good.
Thanks to everyone for listening to that. Check out our social media, rate and review, like and subscribe and all that. And we'll see you shortly for a discussion on John Landis's Spies Like Us.